Hello and welcome to the Texas Tribune Tribcast for the last week of July 2010. I'm reporter Elise Hugh, joined by managing editor Ross Ramsey.
Howdy.
Ben Philpott of KUT News and the Texas Tribune.
Hello.
And for the first and maybe last time, reporter Matt Stiles of the Tribune.
Hi there.
Today we're talking about the political map, the trends we looked at over the past decade, and what that portends for the governor's race this year. A new ranking of toss-up for the race between Perry and White. And finally, Brian Birdwell, State Senator Brian Birdwell, and his eligibility questions. We'll start with the political map first and the trends that Matt looked at this week.
Yeah, so we wanted to, working with the El Paso Times, we wanted to answer the question, can a Democrat win in Texas? So we looked at voting patterns over the last 10 years. We looked at turnout by county in detail, mapped it out. And it looks like if a Democrat can win, it's a very slim margin to victory.
Everything has to fall just exactly right.
Right.
What I thought was particularly interesting was the suburbs. You know, essentially, possibly because I'm from Collin County and y'all talked about Collin County a lot, but just that, A, the voting turnout is so much higher than in places like El Paso County, which is the exact same size or almost the exact same size, and B, how critical it is for the Democrat to essentially take away some of the margins there.
Right, and we looked at, you know, the average D versus the average R over the last several election cycles, and you can see in Collin County, for example, you know, it used to be 3 and 4 votes were for Republicans a few cycles ago, and now it's about 65% for our Republicans. So you see some erosion of Republican support, but it's still, because of the turnout in those counties, that margin, the raw vote total that Republicans take out of those suburban areas like Collin, Denton, Montgomery, Fort Bend, not so much Fort Bend, but the others I mentioned, is pretty powerful for Republicans.
Well, and the voter turnout was really, really markedly different, right? Between some of these counties, like, you know, Elise was mentioning El Paso County and Collin County have about the same size voting age population. But, and Matt, you may remember these numbers, but Collin County's turnout was just off the charts compared to El Paso's. El Paso left a lot of votes on the table.
Yeah, I don't have the exact figures in front of me, but I know that, you know, if you look at voting age population, we looked at El Paso, Fort Bend, Hidalgo, and Cameron. No, I'm sorry, Hidalgo and El Paso. Uh-huh. You know, they're all among the top, the largest counties in terms of voting age population.
Right.
In top 10, top 12, something like that. But El Paso and Hidalgo are at the bottom in terms of their turnout. And you can see all those votes that are left on the table, you know, that might be 70-30, 65-45 for Democrats.
Right. And you can actually see this when candidates travel around. You know, when they're bopping around the state and they go to important places, you know, Republicans tend to make sure they stop in Denton County, Collin County, Tarrant County. Democrats, you know, stop in the valley, but El Paso doesn't get the visits that a city of that size would get if it was voting like a city of Plano's size, right? It's really kind of interesting.
Or Sugar Land, you know, Fort Bend is one where all the statewides notice and make sure that they make appearances there because the turnout's high and the population is high. Mm-hmm. Another thing that we noticed, I mean, obviously there's not a whole lot of new ground here. We wanted to take an academic look at where the state is and what that means in the governor's race. So political insiders probably know all this information already. But one thing that jumped out at me is that Democrats used to have support in the sort of lower panhandle in East Texas, mm-hmm. you know, 10 years ago.
Right.
And that's just gone. I mean, they didn't win any counties on average, you know, in 2008. But they did take over Dallas and Harris counties by slim to growing margins. So it seems like they're winning fewer counties, but they're winning the counties with more people.
I wonder how much of that would be a loss of Congressman Stenholm, was it, who was out there?
Just
being loyal to the Democrat who was out there forever, and then through redistricting, he lost his seat.
Yeah, there were 5 rural Democrats around Texas who, most of them rural, around Texas who lost their seats. Sandlin was one. Stenholm was one, you know, several of those guys, Jim Turner, who lost their seats, and those flipped Republican. That might have something to do with those numbers. Well, where were the battlefields? I mean, if you look at this and you said, you know, if a Democrat was going to win the state, then this would have to happen, and this would have to happen, and this would have to happen. Are there geographic battlegrounds that you found?
Sure. I mean, if a Democrat wants to win, the conventional wisdom is that they've got to get 70% turnout in the border counties, the big border counties that have large populations. White has to make inroads, serious inroads, in places like Collin County and Montgomery County, places that have been dominated by Republicans mm-hmm. in the past. And then, you know, conversely, Perry's got a coast. I mean, you know, it's a red state. It must be nice to run statewide as an R, you know, right. In Texas, especially in this climate. So he's got to not, you know, not do anything to hurt himself in those same places. And then I don't know if he's actually thinking this way sort of cynically, but you don't want to go down to the valley a lot and push up turnout because you know it's going to be 65-45 against you.
You don't want to increase the voter turnout in places where you don't do well.
Right.
And the thing about the valley is a lot of their races, their most contested close races where there's a lot of advertising, happen in March. Ahead of the primary,
right.
You know, because there's so many Democrats. And so by the time it gets to a general election, the reason why they go out for general elections is largely if there's a presidential candidate on the ticket.
Mm-hmm.
Here, I mean, are they going to be excited enough about Bill White to have turnout of, what did you say, 70% or more? I mean, that sounds really steep.
I'm sorry. When I said 70%, I meant he's got to keep his margin of the overall vote at 70%. Obviously, you want to drive up minority turnout, but he's got to keep those margins.
Win them by 70-30.
Yeah,
okay.
But if it's down to 60-40, then it's that's a lot of votes he's losing.
But can he even do that, I think, is the question.
Well, there's this old line in politics that if your election depends on something happening that has never happened before, that's not really a strategy. You could luck into it. Stuff does change over time. And Texas demographics, as you point out in the Democrats' map, they're doing more poorly in rural areas, but better in urban areas and in some suburban areas. So, eventually the numbers could turn. But if you're basing your strategy on something happening that's never happened before, and you can't influence whether it happens or not, that's a pretty tough strategy.
Yeah, because if that worked, we'd be talking about Governor Kinky Friedman today,
or Tony Sanchez, or.
Yeah, or any number of things.
I still don't think we'd be talking about Governor Chris Bell. I'm just throwing that out. I don't,
One last thing on this. Is that there's this immigration law in Arizona, and some Hispanic consultants think that might be something that can be used to galvanize voters. I don't know if the White's campaign is actually thinking along those lines, but
we've thrown that out. I guess last week or maybe even the week before, the idea that for the White campaign, it will be to make sure every Hispanic in the state thinks that Governor Perry is going to implement the Arizona law. And for the Perry campaign, it's to shoot that down throughout the election.
The idea is that issue as a motivator for Hispanic or Latino votes, right?
Or for some. I mean, they're not a monolithic group that, Hispanics in El Paso are different than Hispanics in the border than, Hispanics in Pearland, for example, who might be willing to vote for Perry. So.
Right.
Well, let's stay on the governor's race. Ben and I want to talk about the Washington Post, the Fix blog, now rating the Texas governor's race as a toss-up, largely because of White's fundraising numbers.
Right.
And the fact that there have been some polls that show this race close. Really, just the public policy polling poll is what I noted. So I guess they're looking very closely at money. Ben, your take on this?
Yeah, I mean, it seems like not that the person who does the Fix blog isn't, doesn't know what's going on in Texas. But, I mean, if you wanted something to make it appear that the race is close, especially if you were to compare the 2006 race, there's a lot more money for the Democratic candidate. So if you're kind of looking at it from the margins and you see, well, in 2006, the Democrat raised nothing. And now in 2010, the Democrats outraised the governor. Well, boy, that must be a toss-up.
Well, and $3 million looks like a lot of money anywhere else. I mean, $3 million in Texas doesn't go nearly as far as $3 million in North Dakota goes. And, Bill White came out of the mid-year reports with a $3 million advantage in cash on hand. Most of the people I've talked to, I'm curious what you guys have heard, most of the people I've talked to don't necessarily think he'll go in with a big financial advantage over Perry, but think that that's an indication that both sides in this race are going to have all the money that they want. It's going to be a big, noisy race, I think.
Well, and I think that the noise also maybe is the noise being generated is maybe something that makes people, looking on the fringes think that this is a toss-up. I mean, in the Perry Hutchison race, you had Perry's campaign making all the noise and Hutchison just kind of plodding along. At least over the last month or so, you've had the White campaign, hitting back for just as many punches as Perry has thrown.
Right.
Which again, makes it, and then the money's there, and it has the ingredients to be a contested race. Only the electorate may, show that it isn't. But
yeah, money helps. It's not everything. Kate Hutchison outspent Rick Perry in the primary, and didn't do so hot. And the other thing here underlying this, I'm a little mystified that they called it a toss-up because most of the polling is 9 points.
Right. That's the.
There have been a couple of outliers. This public policy poll that you noted, there was a Rasmussen poll, I think, in April that had it at 4 points. But most of the polling along the way, including ours, is headed in the 7 to 10 point range. You know,
right? If Evan were here, he would call that crap.
Crap.
The toss-up thing. Crap. So, I mean, I guess it remains to be seen, and we certainly want it to be a race. You know, we certainly want it to be.
Here in the fight promotion business, right? You know?
To quote Evan again,
right?
Uh-huh. And in fairness to Saliza, 9 points. You know, in a lot of governor's races where both candidates are funded, in a different state, that's a competitive race.
It's a competitive race. I think it is a competitive race. I'm not sure I'd call it a toss up.
Right.
In fact, I'm sure I wouldn't call it. I think it is a competitive race, though.
Real quick, while we're still on the topic, what did you guys make of this border sheriff's endorsement debacle? It was a back and forth between this week's back and forth. I mean, it seems like every week we're kind of talking about some peripheral back and forth. But this week it was White rolling out all these endorsements from the border sheriffs and Perry coming back and saying, well, actually, two of those sheriffs endorsed us. We have pledge cards.
Does this matter? I don't know if I'd call it a debacle. It's a copy-paste error in a press release.
Right.
I mean, it's two of 20-plus sheriffs that White's, says endorsed him. It's something, if you're the Perry campaign, you're right to seize on to try to, get a few blog headlines. But I don't know that it's going to change things in any way.
If it's important in politics that someone endorsed you, and if it's important to nail them down, then you need to have them sign a piece of paper. And Perry knows that, apparently, because they had signatures from these sheriffs. If you're in a speaker's race, all those people say they're for me. Well, how many signatures you got? If you're in a race for lieutenant governor and the Senate's trying to settle it, how many signatures do you have? It's, names on paper. And Perry had the names on paper here.
There is something that will get, the sort of false endorsement narrative is something that journalists love. I've written stories where a city council member in Houston claimed that his opponent's supporters were his supporters because he kept the list over from a previous race.
Right.
It's something that happens in politics.
Well, I thought one of the interesting things about this was you pulled out the map of how people voted in the Obama-McCain election and the map of how people endorsed in the Perry-White election. And guess what? Sheriffs listened to voters.
Yeah, there was some White going into McCain counties and taking sheriffs and the reverse with Perry. But generally, they sort of, if you overlay the counties where sheriffs endorsed, Perry or White, you can see that clearly the blue and the red counties, the sheriffs went with their voters.
Pretty funny.
And the larger issue is, or the larger question is, whether these endorsements matter at all. I mean, we've talked about it with the Farm Bureau a lot because the Farm Bureau endorsement, and everybody was paying attention to what these guys said to the Farm Bureau, but ultimately it didn't help Kay.
Right. Well, and what I think is interesting is we were trying to find a list of endorsements. Perry's website has an endorsement tab. The White website doesn't. Perry's been in office for 10 years. He's got, I think it's correct, around 2 or 5 gazillion endorsements. And he rolls them out throughout the summer as a big show of support. But, he's been in office for 10 years. I think Bill White's campaign is, they wanted to make a point with the sheriffs. But, other than that, they don't say who's endorsing them. They just kind of roll on through.
How much power does the, Texas Taxidermy Association really have in this election?
How many votes is that in your column?
You'd rather have them than not. I think, if White had lost a whole bunch of Democratic sheriffs, it would look, it would be something he'd have to explain and it would look bad.
Plus, most of your endorsers don't hang really cool stuff on the wall. So, there's that.
All right. Well, for our last topic, Ross is going to bring us up to speed on the curious case of State Senator Brian Birdwell.
Okay. So there's two issues here. Brian Birdwell, according to voting records in Virginia and in Texas, voted in the November 2004 presidential race both here and there. It's a third-degree felony in Texas to vote in more than once in an election. It's the one-man, two-votes problem. So there's that. And then the second issue is sort of more to the point of his eligibility for the state Senate. Texas law requires you to, if you're going to serve in the state Senate, you have to have lived in the state for the 5 years leading up to that and in the district that you're going to represent for the last 12 months of those 5 years. Birdwell was in Virginia. He was one of the people injured when the terrorists crashed the plane into the Pentagon on 9/11. He lived in Manassas. He was serving in the Pentagon. And it's perfectly normal to be in the military and vote in your home state. In fact, he was in the military for 20 years. He voted in Texas, from 1998. He voted in Tarrant County in 98 and 2000 and 2002 and 2004. pretty normal deal. But in 2004, he switched his voter registration to Virginia and began voting in Virginia elections. And the question is whether that establishes residency in Virginia when you're voting for city council people and county commissioners and state senators and all of that stuff there. The last time he voted in Virginia was November 2006. If you run the five-year clock in Texas, and if you take that as residency, then he wouldn't be eligible to serve in the Senate until November 2011. He's in the Senate today, so there's a question. It's a civil matter, and the issue is whether anybody on the Republican or the Democratic side will try to take this to court in the next month or so and get a court to declare him ineligible. It's a fact question for a court, and I don't know how the court would call it, but until someone actually presents the case and says, okay, we're going to challenge this, and it goes to court, it's just sort of an interesting question.
But is it a criminal matter too?
There's a criminal matter potentially on the two-vote thing. It's a third-degree felony to vote twice. The residency thing isn't really a criminal matter. A court would look at it. One of the people I talked to said a court will look at this and say, okay, so if you're a Virginia resident and you're voting in Virginia, then you're ineligible to run in Texas. That's one way to call it. If you are a Texas resident and you're voting in Virginia, that would be a crime. So if a court looks at those and says, you know, option number one is you can't run for office, option number two is it's a crime, the court will usually take option number one. The other thing is a crime if it turns out that, in fact, he did vote in Virginia, as the official record there says, in the same election where he voted in Texas, as the official record here says. If the court says, yeah, you voted twice, that's a felony.
So the reporter in me is just miffed as to why he isn't talking about it. I mean, why not just sit down, try and be open and accessible?
Their response to this was, you know, the voters have spoken. It's time to move on.
But shouldn't, I mean, it's a felony, maybe.
Well, the question is whether prosecutors in Tarrant County at the state level or in Virginia want to pursue that, A. B, on this civil matter of residency, whether any candidate who wants that seat will challenge him and win a residency ruling. So it's really sort of in the hands of prosecutors on one side and other politicians on the other.
Well, voter fraud's pretty big here in Texas.
From what we understand.
From what we've been told for the last three legislative sessions.
Kind of an issue. I mean, it's a really interesting set of questions.
You can't prove a negative.
You know, and one of the other interesting things here, I'm always fascinated by this, is a lot of this information, in fact, most of this information, has been sitting in a file at the Texas Secretary of State's office since April. Birdwell just won a special election with four other candidates in it, and none of the four candidates really pressed this issue in court. And it's because they sort of make a judgment about, okay, there's this risk of presenting this stuff and having voters not like it, and then they won't like me if I present it. There's this risk of not presenting it because then you get to this position where you've been defeated by a guy who may not be eligible for the thing. But none of them pressed the case. It's kind of interesting.
Well, yeah. And I mean, I don't know why they didn't press the case. But, you know, we talk about the criminal versus civil and all that. But generally, politically, residency is not a very salient issue. So you right. can, you know, go all day long and say somebody's a carpetbagger. They just moved into the district. Really doesn't move that many votes.
Mm-hmm. The last case that we had that was sort of, you know, where this was an issue in the race was State Senator Kim Brimer ran for office against mm-hmm. Wendy Davis. And asserted all the way through that campaign that she wasn't eligible to run, and voters didn't like it, and they tossed him out and made her the senator. So one of the things the other candidates were looking at in this race probably was that race, you know, just one cycle ago.
Right. Well, Sibley did bring it up. I mean, he raised the eligibility question, but why not go to the Secretary of State's office and just get the same documents you did?
Sibley actually took the documents to the Secretary of State's office. Secretary of State generally looks at these and says, this is a fact question that needs to be settled in court. So we're going to let everybody onto the ballot, and if anybody wants to go to court, they can go to court. Sibley never took it to court. Neither did Darren Yancey, neither did Gail Avant. None of these people took it to court and challenged it. So it remains legally an unanswered question.
Going forward, what's the likelihood that somebody will come out of the woodwork and decide, hey, I want to get the answer to this legal question?
And another more important point, you know, and I'm not a lawyer, but wouldn't it have to be somebody who was in that race, somebody who has standing? I mean, you couldn't be just an average voter that brings a lawsuit.
You have to have standing. You either had to be in that race or you have to be a candidate coming forward who says, I want to run for the Senate now. against this guy, but the Republican Party has illegally put him on the ballot for November. So that's how you would go in. You would say, hey, I'm Matt Stiles. I'm going to run in this race, and I need to knock this guy out of the way in order to run. A Republican could do that. A Democrat could do that. In fact, in this district, it's a pretty strongly Republican district, and it's probably more likely that a Republican would have a chance to run and win a Senate race in this district by elbowing him aside than a Democrat would. But both of them are looking at
it. So when's the deadline for Birdwell? At what point does he go, okay, now I'm through this?
August 20th is the magic day. Okay. So August 20th is the last day that the parties can pull a candidate off the ballot and replace them with another candidate. So that's the magic date. If someone wants to challenge this, they have to jump now and really get it to rip through the courts.
Yeah, I was going to say, that'd have to be a pretty quick ruling.
You'd have to go, you know, you'd probably have to go directly to the Texas Supreme Court, say this is, you know, this is a case of mandamus. Little side note, the Texas Supreme Court is all Republican, but if it's a Republican versus a Republican, it doesn't really matter. And it really is, you know, it's really sort of an interesting, if you're a legal mook, it's kind of an interesting legal question.
So what's the likelihood that somebody's going to bring this up? That's my big question.
We're waiting to see if anybody's going to raise their hand.
And this is fairly fresh, so we're talking about it on Wednesday. The story aired Wednesday, or the story came out Wednesday. So,
you know, I think we'll know within a week, within a week or 10 days at the very latest, that whether someone's going to press this or not.
Okay, we will wait and see. Big thanks to Matt for sitting in for Evan this week. He will be back next week. If you have any questions or comments for the podcast, you can email us at podcasts@texastribune.org. On behalf of Ross, Ben, and Matt, I'm Elise. Thank you for listening.